From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Black South African actor Zakes Mokai. With playwright Ethel Fugard, Mokai broke the color ban in South African theater. Mokai is now appearing in the U.S. in the films The Serpent and the Rainbow and Cry Freedom. Also today, I talk with Walter Polevchak. At age 12, Polevchak was center stage in superpower relations when he refused to leave America and return home to the Soviet Union with his Ukrainian parents. Now Polevchak's 20 and an American citizen. Rakuta Ken Tucker reviews albums from two performers who split their time between acting and rock and roll, Rick Springfield and Lisa Hartman. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new John Waters movie, Hairspray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Moviegoers who see the new Wes Craven film, The Serpent and the Rainbow, may be surprised to learn the background of the actor who plays the sadistic head of the Haitian secret police. He's Zakes Mokai, a Black South African actor. In 1961, he and white South African Ethel Fugard gave the first interracial theater performance in South Africa. They performed Fugard's play, The Blood Knot. Breaking the racial barrier on stage changed Mokai's life. It led to theater performances later that year in London. Since then, he's returned to South Africa only for two brief visits. Mokai has lived in the United States since 1968. He's remained close friends with playwright Ethel Fugard. In fact, he's best known as the leading interpreter of Fugard's plays about the psychological costs of apartheid. In 1982, Mokai won a Tony Award for his role in Fugard's Master Harold and the Boys. In 1986, he and Fugard performed together on Broadway in a 25th anniversary production of The Blood Knot. I spoke with Zakes Mokai from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. He's currently featured in two films, Cry Freedom and The Serpent and the Rainbow. In his roles in Fugard's plays, Mokai plays victims of apartheid, men who must repress their anger in front of whites. But in The Serpent and the Rainbow, he becomes the oppressor, the head of the secret police who zealously tortures his prisoners.
It's different in the sense that it's so far from what people are used to seeing me do, being the heavy and being nasty.
The heavy,
so,
yeah.
For an actor, I think that's it's fun doing that kind of role.
Now, this character that you play is a real sadist who enjoys torturing his prisoners. Now, I know that in South Africa you were arrested many times and you were probably in the hands of real sadists. Were you able to draw on those prison experiences?
Yeah, that was precisely why I was able to, because I know those characters. I know those people. I know what they do to you. Doing this role, I mean, I was able to draw from that. I've been able to draw from being in a cell, having to sit down and talk to these people, being interrogated, being beaten up, being tortured. So I was able to draw from that, yeah, sure.
How did it feel for you, who had been the victim in South Africa, to suddenly be playing the role of the oppressor, of the torturer?
Well, you do the role. I mean, one is an actor, so you're bound to play all sorts of different things, and you're able to draw from various experiences. So in that sense, I had put myself in one interrogator called Van der Merwe, who at one point or the other, you know, you always used to go past him, and he was a sadist. He enjoyed beating you up.
You said before that you understood something of how these kinds of sadists operate. What are some of the things you've come to understand about them?
Well, you know that they're sadists. They're merciless. They're very, very afraid. They enjoy to inflict pain on other people. That's their basic thing. I mean, when they put you in a room and get interrogated, or just put you in a room where they, you know, you're in solitary confinement, you know, and they enjoy that. You know, they enjoy to see you hanging. They'll have coffee.
In America, you've become best known for your stage roles and specifically for your performances and plays by Ethel Fugard. Are you trying to do more movie roles now? And is it more difficult to find good movie roles than it is to find good roles on the stage?
Yeah, I mean, what you have in movie roles, it's it's kind of hard finding good roles in movies. You know, it's they don't have the more work. Basically, they don't write movies about. You know, they don't write a lot of movies about blacks playing a romantic leads or just leads in terms of, you know, work. So you take what comes along. You know, I mean, how many movies has Sydney done, you know, as compared to Cary Grant?
I know black actors always complain about the Hollywood stereotyped roles that they are up for, roles like pimps and muggers and pushers. When you came to America and wanted to start breaking into black movies, I mean, when you started wanting to break into movies, did you feel like you had to get an understanding of what the black stereotypes were so that you could understand the roles?
It's by whose definition are we talking about stereotypes? You know, I came to America, just wanted to act and stretch. So I experienced certain things and I saw certain things, and that, for me, that was it. It's just the stereotype they always write. I mean, it's like you have a movie being written and they need a doctor. They don't think in terms of a black person as a doctor unless it's specifically written in the script that it's a black doctor. You understand what I'm saying?
Exactly, yeah.
And those are the problems that you're faced with. You say, well, I can be a lawyer, I can play a lawyer, I can play a doctor, but it has to be specific. It has to be written a black doctor or a black lawyer. So somebody else is defining those things for you.
My guest is actor Zakes Mokhai, and he's now co-starring in the film The Serpent and the Rainbow and is also featured in the film Cry Freedom. He's also well known in America for his interpretations of the plays of Athol Fugard. Now, you left South Africa, I guess, around 20 years ago.
Yeah, way back.
Growing up in South Africa, I know blacks were not allowed to act professionally. What kind of exposure, if any, when you were growing up, did you have to movies or theater?
Well, you know, you saw a lot of B-movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you went to the theater and saw a lot of, I saw a lot of Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and Durango Kid. You know, you see a lot of B movies. That's about the only thing you go and see out there. You know, you can't see halfway decent movies. I mean, something like In the Heat of the Night, Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger, you wouldn't be able to see that in Southern Africa. So, you know, you're exposed to almost nothing. You know, I mean, it's hard. I got into acting. Not because they had acting schools. They don't have acting schools. They still don't have acting schools. And you don't plan to be an actor as a black person growing in South Africa. You don't plan to be nothing in South Africa, actually, as a black person. Because the government is always out there to stop you. The government is always out there to tell you, you can do that, you can do this, you can do that. So growing up in Southern Africa as a black kid, it's I don't know how you define it. I mean, it's just that the odds are stacked against you.
Now, I understand that in theater in South Africa that the roles of blacks were played by whites in blackface. Did you ever see any theater like that?
Well, I saw something like that in London when Olivia did Othello.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking that even though acting was not a legal or like legitimate profession for blacks in South Africa, that blacks in South Africa probably had to learn how to act in order to get past tough situations with the authorities.
The thing of playing roles.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know how it's more about survival. You know, you see a cop coming around. You know he's going to ask you a pass. You know he's going to insult you. You know he's going to humiliate you. So you find a way of dealing with him before those things are inflicted upon you. So you do play those roles. You know, on the one hand, you say, I have a picture I'm going to be doing with Marlon Brando and Donald Sutherland. There's a scene where this character that I play is talking to this official, a cop at the airport. And he's very nice. He says all the right things. Yes, sir. Yes, boss. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. As soon as he turns his back, he says, bastard. And that's how it happens in Southern Africa. You just learn to survive.
In 1961, you and playwright Ethel Fugard, who was white, became the first black and white actors to perform together on the same stage. And that created headlines in South Africa. How did you do it? I mean, if it's against the law, how were you able to... Was it in secret that you did it the first time?
Well, basically, I think my favorite phrase is that we call them with their pants down. What happened was that, we used to meet on Saturdays and talk theater or do little sketches here and there. And we had this play. So we rehearsed it without, saying anything. Just the two of us, and I was staying with Ethel, which was only not legal, it was illegal. And, invited a few friends on a Sunday night because there's nothing happening in Southern Africa on Sunday night. Everybody goes to church, or so they say. But they never stop oppressing black people. So we invited a few friends on a Sunday night and critics and just the theater people, and they came and they saw it and they liked it. And they moved it into a little theater. And the government couldn't stop it, basically. But also it's basically because they said, well, they're just two bumps. What, they're not causing any harm. So they let us do it.
You mean actors weren't perceived as being that dangerous a threat to the government?
Yeah, but by the time they found out, it was a bit late.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting out of the country. There was so much publicity on the play that they couldn't do anything.
I interviewed Ethel Fugard a couple of years ago, and he told me that when you and he used to travel together through South Africa, that you didn't want to carry your passbook, and that he used to frequently carry it for you because he was afraid of what would happen to you if you didn't carry it.
Yeah, but you see, he's white. I just, this was just a thing that I was doing on my own. I just refused to carry it.
Did you want him to carry it for you since you weren't
no,
carrying
I
it?
No, I didn't. But each time I got arrested, he had to get me out. So he figured the best way to do it is for him to carry it. I just refused to carry my pass.
Yeah,
and I've been locked up for that a couple of times. So he's the one who used to carry it.
Another thing that he told me was that sometimes if you and he would get into trouble, as you easily could do for being a black and white traveling together, that he would play the role of the white Afrikaner, and he would say that you were his boy and that you were traveling with him. So you both really had to put on a show for the police, basically.
Yeah, you have to. But that's what I said earlier. It's survival, and that's the way you get along. That was the way you used to. It's kind of changed now.
How has it changed?
It's changed in terms of the kids are more prepared to die than go through all this stuff.
So people have gotten more radicalized.
I came out of Sharpeville. You see, these came out of 76. Sharpeville was, that's why Mandela is in jail. Sharpeville was still talking nonviolence, and you didn't have it. Some people were shot. But now what we have here is that people are dying every day. And it's basically kids, and the government has turned around to killing kids. So that in itself tells you something. They are more prepared to die than to play little games. The time for games has passed.
My guest is actor Zakes Mokhai, who is now co-starring in the film The Serpent and the Rainbow. He's featured in the film Cry Freedom. He's a South African actor who left South Africa about 20 years ago, now lives in America. He's performed in many of Ethel Fugard's plays and has performed with Ethel Fugard as well. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Zakes Mokai is my guest. Let me ask you, we were talking about traveling with playwright Athel Fugard. You continued to work together after you left South Africa. He still lives in South Africa, but leaves frequently to produce his plays in America. When you started working with him outside of South Africa, and it was no longer illegal for you to work together, did it change the nature of your friendship and the nature of your working relationship?
No, I think our friendship is still it's still as tight as ever. I think even more so that we're getting a little bit older. No, I don't think so. We understand each other well. Working together, we know what the other one, what's expected of the other person. So, no, it hasn't. It's just actually just improved it and made it much more simpler and easier.
When you first left England, when you first left South Africa, you moved to England to perform The Blood Knot, a play by Athel Fugard. Did you study acting in England while you were
there?
Yeah,
but that was after. When I got to England, I went on to do The Blood Knot, which we did in the West End, and did it for TV. And then I did a couple of other things around the country, but television, mostly television stuff and a couple of plays. Then I just decided, actually John Schlesinger was the one. He said, well, you don't have anything to do. Why don't you go and see what they do in an acting school? I said, yeah, sure. Seeing that I've never been in one. So I made applications to the Royal Academy. And I was shocked when I got accepted. So then I went. I stopped acting for a while and then went out there to see what the hell they're doing. And that's how I got into it.
So you had really been an intuitive actor. You weren't able to study acting in South Africa since acting is illegal for blacks. What was it like to be exposed to this kind of training? Did you like it? Did you resist any of it, preferring to just stay
into
it?
No, I you know, there was it was more the technique. You know how you do things and you can't account for. It's like if I had to say a speech which had 25 lines without taking a break or a pause, I could do that, but I wouldn't tell you technically how I got there.
Mm-hmm.
It was more a gut thing. So when you go to work at the Royal Academy, then you find out technically how they do that kind of thing, that kind of a speech. So in that sense, yeah, I picked up quite a few things. And my stiff upper lip, I can speak English, I think very well, I think, with an upper lip, rather proper.
When you left South Africa to go to England to perform in The Blood Knot, did you know that you would be leaving for good?
No. I had never planned to leave. It was never in my plans to leave South Africa. I went to London and worked. And then one day I just got mad and I packed and I went back home. And 3 days later I got a cable to say, can you come back? We have to do some TV work. So I went back to London, and that's when I stayed.
Since you never officially decided to leave South Africa, are you still going through a decision about whether or not you want to return?
No, I will return at some point. It's not there's no doubt in my mind that I will get back there. I just think that's the right thing to do. You know, like we've been talking about, they don't have this, they don't have that. Now here am I, as an actor, having traveled and having worked, I feel that I need to go back and maybe start up an acting school. I'm sure there are lots of kids who are into acting, now that they know that you can actually make a living out of acting.
How able would you be to actually start an acting school if you went back to South Africa now?
I don't know. I'll just go and start it. Maybe what I do is to raise funds and just go and start a school. You see, if you think about stuff like that in Southern Africa, you'll never be able to do anything because the government can always jam you up. You know, you sit down and you say, well, I don't think, where am I going to open the school? I can't open up the school in town because the government is going to say, no, you can't have a black school in town. Then you say, well, let me go to a black area. Then the government said, no, we don't want a school in a black area because you're talking politics. So, you know, right there you're jammed. So the best thing to do is to just go ahead and do it.
Let me ask you, do you think that you, I don't know, do you think that you could deal with having freedoms taken away after having left South Africa? Do you know, it must be so hard to return to a situation like that once you've gotten out of it.
I mean, well, you never really get completely out of it because you still have freedoms taken away from you in other parts of the world. You know, they might be different, but it's still the same. It's still the same. You know.
Do you feel like you're up against it?
You still have the same things. I mean, you have a president who says that's a tribal war. I mean, how do you deal with it?
Do you feel you're up against a different kind of racism in America?
Yeah, racism is racism, and you know, it's just different. It's how they deal with you. I was in England, and in England they just ignore you completely. They don't see you. I walk into a bar. I say to the man, "Can I have a beer?" There are only two people in there. He just goes about his business. And I say, "Can I have a beer?" He goes about his business. He ignores me completely. Like he doesn't hear me, he doesn't see me. You know what's going to happen? I'm going to get mad. And I'm going to start calling him a bunch of dirty names. He is then going to call the police on me to say that I'm using abusive language. And that's racism. He just ignores you. And that's the way it is. That's the way it goes. So it's you know, in South Africa it's brutal. It's there. You know it, you don't hide it. But why do you think we always have the problems whenever they have to vote or pass some kind of resolution on Southern Africa? The Western countries, the Western democracies. Let's underline the word democracies. Always refrain from punishing or from being very, very, very straightforward with South Africa. Because it's race.
When was the last time you went to South Africa?
I was out there in 82 for my father's funeral and my kid brother got hanged. So the thing is, the Western democracies ignore this. Now, if the whole thing was reversed, they would say the blacks were savages.
When you went back to South Africa, you said your kid brother got hanged?
Yeah.
What for?
Well, you know, he was involved with some stuff out there. And my father, I guess, he died of old age and heartbroken that they could hang somebody.
Did you catch up with friends who you had as a child and as an adult?
Yeah, the ones that are left, most of them are dead or they're in jail, which is where I would have been if I was still out there. I would have either been dead, I wouldn't have been here, or I would have been in jail.
Dead from having gotten beaten up?
Yeah, I mean,
or
they
shot,
lock you up and
dead.
You disappear.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of country we live in. Whenever you leave home, your mother doesn't know whether they're ever going to see you. You don't know if you're ever going to come back.
Do you ever feel, I don't know, I've heard some people who have left their countries, left a lot of oppression in their country, talk about how they feel a certain guilt for having gotten out, knowing that
they left other people behind. I don't feel guilt.
Mm-hmm.
African, South African blacks never feel guilt.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such word in our vocabulary. You're out there. I'm out here to do what I have to do. And they understand that. And they are out there. No, I don't feel that. I don't feel that. Are you saying that we should all feel guilty because we have Mandela in prison?
No, I'm not saying you should feel guilty. I've just heard that expressed by other people, and I was wondering what your reaction was.
No. I don't feel that way. And I don't think most of the people I know in exile don't feel that, but it's something we never even talk about because it's just not there. Guilt is a Western concept.
And we Westerners have plenty of it.
You know, you always feel bad about something. You know, it's okay if you feel bad about something because you have done something bad. Then fine. But, you know, for leaving the country, I can't feel guilty for leaving the country.
I want to ask you one last thing about acting. Are you trying to look for roles that you think have some kind of larger kind of political or social type of
significance? I don't know. I'm just looking for, you know, give me a good role. I'm a ham, you see. I just like to act. So if you give me a good role, you just told me about Serpent and the Rainbow. I was just being a big ham. You know, say act. Say, yeah, I'll be a bad man. You know, that's what it is. I don't think I specifically... Sure, it's nice to do a picture which has some kind of meaning, you know, which says something. Or you always try and make something out of a picture, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess playing the role in Serpent is just showing you how brutal that whole system is. You know, what happens when you ask anybody who's been put in solitary confinement, who's been beaten up. I mean, they know what it is. Why do you think people still get mad when you mention Hitler?
I haven't seen Cry Freedom yet. What kind of role do you have in that?
Well, I play the opposite. I play a priest. I'm sort of the guru. I plan up, Wood's escape with the manuscript and stuff like that. I'm a guru. It's a role that you'd like. I guess you're used to me playing those kind of roles. It's a straightforward role, a priest and, a good-hearted man who's, just trying to help.
I like it, you know, that as an actor it's sometimes more fun to play the heavy than the good guy probably, right?
Yeah, well, it depends. It depends, you know, the heavy, you have to, you know, if you're going to play a heavy, you have to be a heavy. You know, heavies don't, it doesn't work if you go halfway through. You know, it's, people say, how can you nail that guy's balls onto the chair? You know, I have to do that to show how bad or how brutal and vicious this whole thing is. You know, torture. Torture is a terrible thing. You know, they make you do strange things. You know, so you have to, you're playing a heavy, you have to bring all that up that, you know, people would sit and say, damn, that's real, that's nasty. In its own way, people start thinking, you know, that's not the way we should be living. But we have those people who go around torturing people. I mean, it's their life. They sit and they enjoy it. So, I don't know. I think you just try and do something to a role. And hopefully it has some kind of meaning to somebody. Or somebody learns something out of it. Or gets something out of it.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in more roles. And I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been actor Zakes Mokhai, who is now appearing in the films Cry Freedom and The Serpent and the Rainbow. He's also starred in many of Ethel Fugard's plays. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Françoise Gillot. She's an artist and writer who for many years lived with Pablo Picasso. They had two children, Claude and Paloma. Gillot is the author of the book My Life with Picasso and a new book titled An Artist's Journey. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's hard enough just being a teenager. Walter Polovchak spent most of those years in Chicago courtrooms, fighting his parents' insistence that he return with them to the Soviet Union. The controversy ended only when he turned 18 and became an American citizen. We'll find out what he's up to now. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new records by soap opera stars Rick Springfield and Lisa Hartman. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Hairspray, John Waters' satire of the 60s teen dance scene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. A Democratic-sponsored contra-aid plan failed in the House today. The $30 million package was defeated on a vote of 216 to 208. The Reagan administration opposed the plan because it contained no military aid. The package was approved in an earlier vote as an amendment to a Republican alternative, but it was finally defeated in the vote on the amended bill. Contra rebels say they will meet with Sandinista government officials later this month in Nicaragua, but they have rejected a proposal by President Daniel Ortega to dismiss mediator Cardinal Miguel Obando y Bravo. The Contras say they want Obando present at the talks as a moderator and a witness. The State Department has criticized the proposed dismissal of Obando, accusing the Sandinistas of avoiding the political issues in the ceasefire talks. NATO leaders have ended their two-day conference in Brussels after reaching agreement on keeping Western nuclear defenses up to date. President Reagan sounded optimistic today as he left Brussels for Washington. More from NPR's Bill Buesenberg.
In the end, NATO dropped the word modernization from its final communique and substituted the term up to date instead. That pleased the West Germans, who declared it a small victory. Modernization suggests to the Germans that NATO is planning new, possibly more powerful, battlefield nuclear weapons on their territory. And the public sentiment in West Germany and within the European peace movement favors more nuclear disarmament, not more nuclear weapons. The United States and Great Britain, which advocated modernization, said the term up-to-date means the same thing. Officials pointed out that the Soviets are continuing their modernization efforts, so therefore the alliance should keep its nuclear deterrent strong as well. This outcome of the NATO summit led one peace group leader to say today that having raised expectations among the European public, both NATO and the Soviet Union are undermining the process of disarmament at its beginning. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Brussels.
The Transportation Department is proposing drug tests for tens of thousands of airline employees in safety and security-related jobs. Transportation Secretary James Burnley says the tests, which are due to begin in several months, are needed to maintain public confidence in the aviation system. And the Senate today approved a bill designed to combat what some senators are calling the growing misuse of polygraph tests by employers. It prohibits most employers from using lie detector tests to screen job applicants and randomly test the honesty of employees. Differences between the Senate measure and similar legislation passed in the House must be worked out in conference committee. A Houston federal jury today found Soldier of Fortune magazine negligent in publishing a classified ad that led to the paid killing of a Texas woman. NPR's John Burnett reports.
After deliberating for 2 days, the jury ordered the Mercenary magazine to pay $9.4 million in actual and punitive damages to the family of Sandra Black. She was shot to death in 1985 at her home in the East Texas city of Bryan. Her husband, Robert Black, arranged the killing after reading a personal services ad in the back of Soldier of Fortune magazine. He paid $10,000 to a self-described mercenary named John Wayne Hearn. Hearn is now serving a life sentence in Florida, and Robert Black is on death row in Texas. The ad read in part, ex-Marine, Vietnam vet, weapons specialist, jungle warfare, high-risk assignment in U.S. or overseas. During the two-week testimony, the magazine's publisher, Robert K. Brown, argued unsuccessfully that they had no way of knowing the ad was for illegal activity. The trial is considered important because now other publications could be held liable for actions linked to their classified ads. In Austin, this is John Burnett reporting.
Chrysler Corporation today announced it will not sell its AccuStar subsidiary. Chrysler faced union opposition for its plans to spin off the parts-making company. Instead, the number three U.S. automaker said it would close or sell four small AccuStar plants over the next 18 months. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 8 points to close at 2063.49. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For 10 weeks in 1964, actor Lorne Greene was on top of the pop charts, even while he continued to manage the Ponderosa on TV's Bonanza. His hit was a song called Ringo. Record of Ken Tucker explores the crossover between the television studio and the recording studio, and he has a review of two new albums from stars who have left one for the other.
There's a long, if not exactly illustrious, history of television performers yearning to become part of the rock and roll world. The first example of this tendency remains the best. Ricky Nelson, the whining, smart-aleck little brother in The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, established himself as one of the best singers in 50s rock through pure strength of will. He wanted it so bad that he did it. He turned himself into a first-rate Elvis Presley disciple. Other teen idols didn't fare as well. Real rock fans still play Ricky Nelson music, but no one plays the junk recorded by Bobby Sherman or David Cassidy or Sean Cassidy. Yet all of them were big TV stars in the 60s and 70s. Bravely attempting to buck this historical tendency are Lisa Hartman and Rick Springfield.
Well, I pick up my guitar, I look in the mirror. It's like a stranger in my head. There comes a time when the boy must leave, and the man has to enter.
That's Rick Springfield and Rock of Life from the album of the same name. It's an okay song, I guess, but it rather lacks personality, don't you think? Now here's Lisa Hartman.
Talk about freedom, like it's just the greatest thing going. And a fever shakes my body when I think of spending one more night alone.
That song is called Tempt Me If You Want To, and the song sounds as awkward and vague as its title. Now, let's make the case for these two as legitimate rockers. First of all, they were both professional musicians before they became TV stars. Springfield as a doctor on General Hospital, Hartman as the much-abused C.G. Dunn on Knots Landing. Springfield, in fact, had a hit record in 1981 called Jessie's Girl that many critics, most certainly including myself, thought was very good indeed. And he followed it up that same year with a tune called I've Done Everything For You, You've Done Nothing For Me, that remains to this day the most spiteful rock record this side of the Rolling Stones Under My Thumb. The closest Springfield comes to hard-edged excellence on this new album, however, is on a song called Honeymoon in Beirut. Rick Springfield's album has the air of someone who knows he's never going to be hip with people who admire Sonic Youth or the Pet Shop Boys, and he doesn't really give a hoot. Lisa Hartman, on the other hand, gives many hoots. Her album strives to be all things to all listeners. She tries to rock hard one minute and sing softly the next.
It's more than I could ever say with words. It's more than tears and fears and living in different worlds. When you're out there on your own, you're not alone. Till my heart stops beating, you'll be to me the one that keeps me going, stronger than my wildest dreams.
Hartman has a strong, sure voice, and with the right song, she could easily get herself a hit. And that, ultimately, is the only way a TV star makes it in rock, on the strength of hit records. They don't have the advantage of establishing a personality slowly, through their music, the way most rock performers do. Their personalities have been all too clearly delineated on their TV shows. Their television fame denies them any mysteriousness or the possibility of unpredictability that most struggling rock acts take for granted. Hartman and Springfield understand that they have to give themselves over to the music. And as sincere and listenable as it is, the music here probably isn't going to make them rock stars.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Shaking in my hands, will it ever quit? I'm near the door, I just have to open it. Will you recognize my face when you see me in the light? If you feel out of place.
This is Fresh Air. Jello, toilet paper rolls, and bananas are the things Walter Pilifchak first fell in love with about America. He was 12 years old when his parents emigrated here from the Soviet Union. Soon after the family arrived, his parents decided to go back to their home in the Ukraine. Walter, however, liked it here and asked the U.S. government to grant him political asylum against his parents' wishes. His case and the numerous court battles that followed became front-page news. Walter's 20 now and a U.S. citizen. He's written a book about his experiences in the United States titled Freedom's Child. I asked Walter when he first became aware of his parents' dissatisfaction with America.
My dad basically made up his mind to return back to Soviet Ukraine the first night we arrived here. We drove from O'Hare Airport in Chicago to my aunt's house on the northwest side, where he was complaining that he couldn't stand it here. He was depressed and he was bored. He couldn't handle life here already the first night, and he wanted to return us. And we figured he'd adapt to the thing, you know, he'd kind of fall in place. And as time went on, he started calling Soviet embassy, and it came to the point where he said, I'm going back. And he tried to go back by himself, and basically his whole idea was to dump the family here.
Why didn't he just go by himself?
The Soviet government would not let him go back by himself. If he came back by himself, people would have started saying, if it's that bad, why'd you come back and left your entire family back? When he came back with the rest of the family, with my brother and my mother, then there was a big propaganda for Soviet Union saying, well, America is really bad, like we were telling you, and this and this. But story about me, they were writing articles that I was kidnapped and drugged, and that was taken away from them, basically.
I want to ask you about when you ran away from your parents. After you found out that they wanted to leave and that they expected you to come with them, you ran away with your sister to live at your cousin Walter's apartment?
Right.
Your parents reported you missing, and the police found you and took you to the police station.
Right, they took me to the police station. I was scared and lost because I don't know what was going on. I was in my backyard fixing up my bike where police came and grabbed me and brought me to the police station in Chicago, and I was there for quite a few hours before anybody came to my rescue or my help or anything, because nobody knew where I was at to start with.
What did you think was going to happen?
At that point, I was just scared to death because I don't know what was going to happen.
You said that you would have preferred to never see your parents again rather than to have to go back to the Soviet Union if there was a choice between that. It seems like such a strong statement for a 12-year-old to make. And you were 12-year-old when you said it.
It's a strong statement, but I had to look out for my best, what was best for me. And, you know, Soviet Union is just not another country like Canada or England or other countries like that where if it was in the same situation, fine, I would have been more than happy to go back to England or Canada or free countries where I could reach 18 or 21 and come to the United States because that's where I really want to be. Soviet Union is not like that. It's just a completely different country. It's when you go there, it's like you'll never get out. It's like going to hell.
There was a series of trials, and during the trials, you were still very new to America, and you didn't speak much English. It must have been very confusing to you as your fate was being debated in the courtroom because you must have had trouble following what all the lawyers were saying.
I was scared to death because nobody would ever give me any type of guarantee for the whole period from the time I ran away from home till the day I got my citizenship in my hands that I was going to be able to stay in the United States, and nobody ever gave me any guarantee, so I live in fear through every single going day to day, not knowing what was going to happen in court today or what was going to happen tomorrow or next week or on and on.
When did your parents leave America to return to the Ukraine?
My parents, they were intent. They wanted to leave within 6 months because the visa was still good for the 6 months. You know, they could still return without making new papers, but things got a little tied up with me running away and everything. And about a year and a half later, I was going on visitations to them with the State Department. You know, just hopefully we could reconcile, you know, and get the family back together. Where I seen them packing up, and I said, "Where are you guys going?" "Well, we're moving to suburbs with our friends." Not me thinking for a moment, you know, I didn't think much of it, and that was like on a Friday. Where next thing I see on the news, they're getting on a plane, boarding to go to the Soviet Union.
When your parents returned to the Soviet Union, you stayed here along with your sister Natalie, but your youngest brother, who was seven at the time,
he
went back with your parents to the Soviet Union. Do you miss him?
Yes, I do. And in fact, when my parents went back, they had another child, which is like 2 years old now. Her name is Julie. It's my little sister, and I never seen her yet. So I'd like to see her in the near future somewhere.
Your brother must be very curious about you, too, about what's happened with your life.
I'm sure he is.
Before the split happened in the family, were you close with your parents?
Our family has never been close. My dad's been he was a bus driver, so he was home twice a week maybe, or so three times with luck. So, and my mother was working in the afternoons, you know, when I was in school in the morning. So we never had a good relationship as a family together to start with, which I think kind of led to even more breakdown.
One of the issues that came out in this trial is, should a 12-year-old have the right to decide which country they're going to live in, and should a 12-year-old have the right to separate from their parents if their parents want to live in a place different from the place that the 12-year-old wants to live in? Now that you're a few years older, well, have your ideas on that changed at all?
My ideas haven't changed. In fact, I'm very glad that I made the decision. I would do it again if I had to. But I'm not saying it's right that the parents got no rights to take their kids with them. But then, you know, I would look out also on the other hand for my kids. If I was going to take my kids to some country where they're going to be punished and they're going to be marked for the rest of their lives due to this, I would definitely think about twice about going back.
During the long period of trials that you went through, did you ever feel like you were being used as a pawn in the Cold War with, different sides trying to capitalize on your case?
I don't think anybody was really capitalizing on me, or I think everybody that was really involved in it was basically doing it in my interest and out of their own heart because they knew where I was coming from. And I don't think people really took advantage of me.
The appeals were still in process when you turned 18, but when you turned 18, you legally became an adult. And then the case got thrown out because as an adult, you have the right to decide where you're going to live, so your parents could no longer claim custody over you. How did you celebrate your 18th birthday?
I went to Washington, D.C. I did a few TV shows while there because it was a real big and emotional thing for me because I was, like, struggling till this date. And that's why I wrote the book. I just want American people to know what kind of struggle I went through and how much I fought for freedom. So I'd just like to say to them, don't take freedom for granted. It's the most precious thing you could have.
How did you get to learn English? Did you just pick it up, or did you study it?
Picked it up. I think it took me like about a year and a half or so before I really started speaking and understanding I could have a regular conversation.
A lot of Soviets who move to the United States end up living in Soviet emigre communities where, you know, you can speak Russian and people will understand, where there's a certain amount of Russian foods that are sold, and a certain amount of Russian culture is maintained. Do you live in a Ukrainian or Soviet community?
No, I don't. I'm not that far from Ukrainian community. In fact, I used to be pretty well involved with the Ukrainian community, playing soccer for the Ukrainian club and doing all kind of things like that. And it's, I think as you get older, life gets a little more complicated, and I don't have that much free time to do those kind of things. Now, I got to work full time now and go to school and a lot of other things to take care of.
You're in college now?
Right. I'm living in Chicago now on the northwest side, and I'm working for a public relations company, Hill & Knowlton, where I just do general office, run Xerox machine, and do their mail. And I go to Columbia College, where I'm pursuing my education with TV broadcasting.
Really? How come you chose that?
I've been around media for such a long time on a every day or every weekly basis or every monthly basis, where it became part of my life. So I got real interested, and I like to see what it's like to be on the other side.
So what do you want to be, an anchor person, a reporter? Anchor person?
Right. Hopefully I could do something like you're doing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with
thank
us.
Thank you.
Walter Plevchak's account of his life in the United States is titled Freedom's Child. Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, tonight, Terry, we visit the cocaine capital of America, and I'm going to let you guess where that is.
Miami?
Yep. After several years of Miami Vice, I think everyone would take that, make that same guess. It turns out we speak tonight to those who really battle drug smugglers. That's the Drug Enforcement Agency. And they say that there's no way we can win the war on drugs. And further, we discover that the South Florida economy is booming principally because of the drug trade. We also have a story tonight on the latest development in the controversy over recording digital audio tape.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Hairspray is the new movie from director John Waters, the man who has both grossed out and delighted audiences with films like Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble. Waters has cleaned up his act in Hairspray, and film critic Stephen Schiff is sorry he did.
15 years ago, John Waters emerged from the drear of Baltimore with the archetypal midnight movie hit, Pink Flamingos. It was a self-proclaimed exercise in poor taste, in which a huge transvestite called Divine and her family vied with their crosstown rivals to be named the filthiest people alive. Well, it's a long road from there to his latest film. Hairspray is a cuddly soap operetta. It's so squeaky clean you can fearlessly bring the kids along. I have mixed feelings about this movie. No one can deny it's enjoyable. Waters' campy evocation of lower middle-class Baltimore in 1962 may be awfully familiar by now, but it's still fun to see those incredible towering hairdos and the fabulous 50s furniture. And it's a pleasure to be ushered yet again into the world of dances like the Mashed Potato and the Madison, and TV dance programs like the Corny Collins Show.
Please have Luann Lavorowski and IQ Jones lead a dance. Signed, your number one fan in West Baltimore. Here they come now. Come on up here, kids.
Hi, Corny.
Hi, West Baltimore.
And what's your favorite record from the survey?
Gravy!
All right, here's IQ Jones and Luann Lavorowski leading our next dance. Give me gravy on my mashed potatoes. Yeah.
Like most of Waters' films, Hairspray is about the rivalry between a low-rent good family and an equally low-rent evil family. The good guys here are chubby Tracy Turnblad, winningly played by Ricky Lake, and her mom and dad, played by Divine and Jerry Stiller. Tracy wants more than anything to be a regular dancer on the Corny Collins show. Who cares if she's a mite hefty? She knows how to shake a tail feather. Her rival is the nasty blonde Amber Von Tussle, whose evil stage parents, played by Debbie Harry and Sonny Bono, will stop at nothing to make sure little Amber remains Baltimore's ultimate teen queen. But in Waters' dewy reminiscence, the kids are basically sweethearts. They accept Tracy despite her size, and then they go on to demand racial integration on the previously all-white Corny Collins show. Even Corny himself stumps for civil rights. The true subject of Hairspray turns out to be that moment when 50s self-centeredness gave way to 60s tolerance. But I differ with those critics who think the movie is a parody of social protest blockbusters like The Defiant Ones and A Patch of Blue. Hairspray is no parody. It's utterly sincere. It's Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Beehives. Waters' wit and his perfect memory make the movie fun every inch of the way, but I couldn't help feeling a twinge of disappointment. Where, I wonder, has the vicious, crazy, anything-goes Waters of the 70s gone? The one who could make a harsh, garish, unbearable masterpiece like Female Trouble? That was a social protest movie with real teeth. Hairspray is safe and mild, and it goes down a little too easily. In his bid for the mainstream, I just hope John Waters hasn't lost the terrible taste that once made him an underground hero.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
Hey, girl, what you doing over there?
Can't you see? I'm spraying my hair.
Let me tell you about the latest craze. Mama's hoping that it's just a phase, but I know it's gonna last forever. You gotta see the way it keeps my head together. I gave my dollar to the drugstore man. I bought that magic potion in a 12-ounce can. Oh, I know. But when I make the scene, they're gonna stop and wonder who's that beauty queen now.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, the first of a two-part interview with jazz singer and songwriter Dave Frischberg. He'll be at the piano to play and talk about his songs like My Attorney Bernie and to pay tribute to his heroes like Frank Lesser. Also, a song about apartheid from Tony Bird, a white African singer-songwriter who grew up in the country of Malawi. And critic at large Laurie Stone will review the women's Olympic figure skating competition and the women she thinks lost out because they didn't fit the idealized image. So I hope you can join us. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have a couple of minutes, drop us a line. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.